Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep and we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. And this episode is made in partnership with Anglo American. Today we're looking at the crucial role of biodiversity in agriculture, and specifically we're asking, what role do sustainable fertilisers have to play? We've made episodes in the past looking at how important biodiversity is within soil, and it can be incredibly complex stuff. The British journalist, author and activist George Monbiot has previously told this podcast, soil is home to an ecosystem as diverse and abundant as a coral reef. So it's far more than just dirt, and protecting its biodiversity is as crucial now as it has ever been. To explore how that can be done while still maintaining crop yields, I am delighted to be joined by Colin Chappell, who is an arable farmer. Hello there, Colin.
Hello.
Great to have you. We've also got Eloise Griffin-Hicks, commercial agronomist, UK and Ireland, for Anglo-American Crop Nutrients. Hello there, Eloise.
Hi.
Great to have you as well. Now, let's start off with you, Colin. Biodiversity plays a big part in our lives. The UN defines biodiversity as the variety of life on Earth and the natural patterns it forms, which is a little vague. So to start this session off, could you elaborate a little bit more on what biodiversity means for you?
Sure. Break it down. Biological diversity. To me, means three different things. It can either be within a species, as in genetic diversity, between the species, or even between ecosystems. And it's their richness and their variety of life on this earth, and it's how it affects each other. So it's how it builds up its own diversity in the ecosystem to make it more resilient and therefore better placed to support more life. So that after some form of shock, as in my case, cultivation, or a fire, or a drought, or a flood event, it is better placed to get over that shock, and it is better placed to react to that form of and recover faster from that shock that it's been placed under.
Is it something that you think about on a daily basis? I mean, you're an arable farmer, presumably. This is crucial to your work, to your land, and its longevity. Is it at the top of your mind, but kind of all the time?
It has become so, yes. And I can't believe I'm about to say this, but it's the one thing I probably do agree with George Monbiot on, in the fact that that we really do. Soil is now my entire focus. I always thought it was really important, but I must admit your title there, where we thought about it as dirt, it is now much more than dirt. It is a living, breathing system on its own. And therefore, how do I handle such a delicate ecosystem? Now encompasses absolutely everything I'm focused on as I go through the course of a year. Yes.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot more realization of the complexity, I think, in a lot of the podcasts that we've done.
Oh, and we don't know a lot about it yet. We know more about the bottom of the oceans than we do about our soil.
Yeah.
And therefore, what am I doing on my farm reacts with the microbes and the stuff in the soil that we don't know about, and therefore that is becoming my focus nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where it gets fascinating for me. So, Eloise, from your point of view, how does biodiversity contribute to agriculture, and why does it need to be protected?
It needs to be protected purely so that we can actually secure food for future generations. If we keep on taking from the land and disrupting the natural processes, which help with things like nutrient cycling, keeping crops healthy, we're going to be left with nothing in a very short period of time. And you can sort of trace it all back to the sort of introduction of inorganic chemical fertilizers during the Green Revolution. And there was a very good reason why we did that. We needed to increase food production to sustain the country. Now, practices don't seem to have changed that much since the Green Revolution, despite all we know about biodiversity and microbes and how we need to keep the soil ecosystem healthy. So if we just keep on taking and don't give back and don't give back the right things in the right way, we will be left with literally nothing. We'll be left with dead soils that don't produce, no matter how much inorganic fertilizer you throw at it. So talking to Colin and understanding how he can look after his soils and how us as a company with our product can also help to protect that ecosystem is it's of the utmost importance for, you know, I don't mean to sound dramatic, but, you know, the future of the human population.
Well, you have sounded dramatic, but that's good. We appreciate that, I think. So now we know that fertilisers play a crucial role in growing crops, and particularly on a large scale. But how can that translate? How can the use of sustainable fertilisers support biodiversity? How does it work?
Yeah, it's certainly needed. So I'm not for any minute saying that we're going to get rid of all, you know, nitrogen inputs, because we do need it to produce enough food to feed the country. But we can certainly be doing it in a smarter way, in a more sustainable way, and in a way that protects the soils a lot better than we have done. So what I would myself encourage farmers to do, and anyone that's looking after the land, is to really analyse what you're doing to it, analyse what you're putting into it, and what you want to get out of it at the other end of, you know, harvest or the next 50 years. So to really start looking carefully at what we're doing, you know, just for an example, if we're looking at putting on 250 kilos of nitrogen to a winter wheat crop, well, what's the aim? Are we aiming to get so many tons of wheat, or are we aiming to get enough wheat that makes a profit and makes the whole business profitable? So there's a really fine balance to be had. And I think it all comes from education and changing practices. And, you know, Colin is a great example for rethinking the way that we do things and changing the way that we look at farming. But it also, at the end of the day, needs to be an enterprise that's sustainable. Farmers can't live off nothing at the end of the day, and they do need to make a profit. So where is that line from being sustainable but also being productive as well? So hence why working in agriculture is a really interesting area for me.
It's a really difficult balance as well, though, isn't it? So Colin, let's get practical about this. I guess it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. I have no understanding of how fertiliser impacts soil. So over to you, really. How and where fertiliser use can presumably have a huge impact on biodiversity. So it's important that they're managed properly. So can you talk us through the right approach to nutrient management?
Sure, because we must say from the outset, fertilizers can do as much damage as they can benefits. And therefore, we're talking about the four R's of the right source, the right rate, the right time, and in the right place. And that is how we use them sustainably, like Eloise was talking about. More particularly with nitrogen, shall we start with that? Ammonium nitrate is a form of nitrogen we can use, but it has the potential to leach. Urea is another source of nitrogen, but it has a potential in dry conditions to volatilize. So we must match the fertilizer source that we're using to the conditions we're in, whilst also matching growth and uptake of those fertilizers at that time. And we can do that on our farm by measuring it through the course of the year and monitoring the weather around us. We have a weather station on our farm. So if it's going to be far too wet, then we won't put ammonium nitrate on. We can replace it with foliar products if required at the time. Eloise was talking about sustainability. We've just grown an oilseed rape crop with 42 kilos of nitrogen, whereas the average farmer would be putting 170 kilos of nitrogen per hectare on that, or maybe even more. You know, historically I'd put more on, but it's about managing what's in front of you, and if the crop doesn't need it, why are you putting extra on it? Why are you putting excess on it? But also it's about the right product, because with nitrogen you have other things like sulfur, which helps the uptake of the nitrogen. It helps balance the nitrogen within the plant. And a plant helps to, it requires it to manufacture sugars and protein, but in a balanced way. And therefore you add the sulfur into it. If we're talking about the P's and K's, the other stuff other than nitrogen that we can put on, we can place that with the seed to help it grow. So there's a product called DAP, diammonium phosphate, that we can place beside the seed to help the seed bounce out the ground faster and therefore make it more resilient to droughts going forward. Now, I've gone one stage further than that. There is a struvite version of that that is just the way it's manufactured, and it's made in a different way. And it does exactly the same job, but without using so much nitrogen. DAP has a bit of nitrogen with it. So what I'm sort of saying is, do you often need some of these products? Do you need all the P and K? Do you need the amount of nitrogen we've put on historically? we've got tools in our armory now to change all that. And it's just by talking about the 4 hours approach to nutrient management and then trying to target it for your particular circumstances, I guess.
And just to be clear, you talked about volatilization with ammonium nitrate. What does that mean?
Volatilization, it's actually with urea, Stefan. That's with urea. So if, for example, you get a bit of rain, but it's not enough rain to wash it into the soil, you will end up, the process of urea has to take several steps to make it available to the plant. And if it doesn't get to the plant straight away, it has this potential to disappear into the atmosphere. It's called volatilization. So you need, with urea, you need putting it in the colder times of the year and with enough moisture so that it's absorbed straight into the soil so it can be taken up by the plant.
And this is interesting. You're talking about the right timing to use these. Does this apply across the board? So, you know, that's one specific about the timing of use of fertilizer. Are there any other things that we need to know about the right time to use the right to use a particular fertilizer?
Yes. So, you're trying to match what the plant needs and when it needs it. So therefore, that's why we're placing the phosphate with the seed. And then we're trying to, if you're at peak growth, we take tissue tests and sap tests. We take a sample of the plant and see what it requires at that time. And then we can match the inputs to what the plant requires at the time. So there are measures we can do.
Yeah. And it's different for different times. Okay, so let's get into a bit of the detail. You said the right source. What are the other things that need to be considered to make sure that you're using the right kind of fertilizer?
Well, I seem to be labeled with this sustainability issue now. So we have to make sure what we're doing is sustainable. And it's we as farmers, we have to make sure that we are doing what is right for the farm. But we are now trying to question where we're getting the source of our fertilizer from as well. For example, there is a product called triple superphosphate. It is mined from rock, and it's often rock that isn't in our country. It's often from Australia or other parts of the world. Is it really sustainable to harvest a product from another part of the world, ship it to this country, and then find out it's only 4% efficient at being taken up by our plants? It's not the right source, and it's not the right material, and you can't say it's sustainable for the plants going forward. We have other products that we can use that can replace this sort of stuff, the triple superphosphates, for example. And we need to question what we're doing as farmers and find a sustainable way of going forward.
Okay, now let's look at specifically how biodiversity is impacted. So Eloise, Colin said he was talking about the right rate. On the face of it, you know, just adding in lots of nutrients might seem like the best way to increase biodiversity. But is that not the case?
Unfortunately not. I mean, if you look at nutrients and nutrient application, I'll pick nitrogen just because it's an easy one to pick on. You end up with a curve and you reach a plateau, and past that point, adding more nitrogen will not increase your yield. So with nutrients, it needs to be a balance. And you'll hear us say balance all the time when we're talking about fertilizer plans. And that's purely because chucking on lots and lots of different types of nutrients doesn't increase yield, doesn't increase quality. What you need to think about is that some nutrients, when applied in excess, will lock up other nutrients and make them unavailable in the soil. If they're unavailable in the soil, they're unavailable to the plant and the plant can't take them up. So there is an optimum to all nutrient applications. And I don't think there's ever a talk about fertilizer that I've ever done where I haven't mentioned Liebig's law of the minimum. And that means that if you are deficient in just one nutrient, it doesn't matter if it's a macronutrient or a micronutrient, that will be the upper end of your yield and the limit to your yield. So therefore, it's really important to look at the picture as a whole and make sure that everything is in balance. And you might actually be surprised that when we start looking at a balanced nutrition program, we don't need to be using huge amounts of each nutrient in isolation, but rather using the right amount of the right nutrient at the right timing is what's going to give you the best benefit. And not only that, but it's definitely the more sustainable way of doing things rather than chucking on these products, which are often acidifying, often containing salts and chlorides, which are all pretty poisonous to the soil in certain situations and can damage the plant, and they can damage, certainly damage the microbes inside the soil, which are responsible for cycling the nutrients. So if at all possible, we're wanting to minimize the impact that we're having on the soil through our nutrient applications, and therefore using products which are on the more natural side of the spectrum rather than the chemical side of the spectrum is where we're going to have to start moving.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on from the talking about the potassium and phosphorus for a second, and talk about sort of the practical application of these things. So, Colin, there are different farming practices that can help to nurture biodiversity, such as incorporating buffer areas around sensitive areas to prevent spray drift or runoff and things like that. What type of farming practices do you apply on your farm to support biodiversity? I presume there's a range of different things.
Yeah. So specifically for fertilizers in particular, we have areas where we don't apply fertilizer. We have, as you say, buffer strips around the edges of fields. I have 14 kilometers of ditches on my farm. I have to make sure, because I work in conjunction with Angling Water quite a lot, and they harvest water from basically the land around me, and I have to make sure that I'm not putting anything into the water that then can harm ultimately my drinking water that comes back the other way. So we have these buffer strips. We have often awkward corners on the farm where you can't get the spray or the fertilizer into properly. Well, why are you even trying? Let's straighten up those fields. Let's make this straight line farming. Let's take them out of production. Let's create a wildlife area in there. And by straightening the field, we can often produce more from the resulting land that's left than we can from ever chasing that little 0.2 of a hectare in a corner that we go to. We use liquid fertilizer. So we use a product called UAN. It's stuff that I can put through my sprayer and means that I'm actually placing it exactly where I need to. I'm not chucking fertilizer a little bit further to get to the right to the edge of the field, because I know my sprayer nozzles will actually take it right to the edge of the field and it will be put exactly where I want it. Also using the sprayer, I can individualize the nozzles, so therefore it's not overlapping too much either. Further to that, I talked about placing the fertilizer. So often at drilling, we will place the fertilizer with the seed to allow the seed to bounce out the ground. So you're not blanket applying across your whole acreage. You are specifically targeting fertilizer to the seedling to produce a better growth pattern in that particular plant.
Okay. And Eloise, what other practices would you recommend applying?
Yeah, I think certainly the ones that Colin had mentioned are all up there with, you know, the best ways to increase biodiversity. I think what you could also do is start introducing cover crops, so to try and increase organic matter in the soil, which is bound to have a positive effect on microbes and diversity within the soil. But not only that, you're not leaving the ground bare and fallow, either over winter or between one harvest and drilling your next crop, which will support things like, you know, insect life and therefore bird life. And thinking of it as a sort of a food web, you know, back from primary school days where we learn about spiders feeding birds, etc. To support the whole ecosystem, you need to have something there, and that will come down to the farmer doing it. And not only that, having a cover crop on the ground can also help to capture nutrients that would otherwise just be running off. So we're talking phosphates and nitrates as well, and maybe a bit of potassium as well combined in that. And then what you do is you destroy the cover crop, return it to the soil. That increases the organic matter in the soil, and then it also means that the nutrients are then starting to be decomposed by microbes to be ready for the next crop that you put in.
Mm-hmm. Well, makes a lot of sense.
And farmers often grow, and the negative side to it, Eloise, is the price of the cover crop and the fact you're putting the cover crop in. But we must get farmers to do that more often for the reasons you're saying. We're covering the soil, we're protecting the soil, we're creating an armor to the soil. And on my heavy clay soils, it's not always possible to get the cover crops in, but I have to find a way to do it, because we don't know what benefits we could be adding to the microbes in the soil. I can see it on sandy soils, it works really well, but a lot of people go on heavy soils, it doesn't work. But we have to make it work. We just have to make it work, because we we have to keep feeding the microbes in the soil. We have to keep them alive and keep them healthy, because they ultimately are keeping our plants healthy.
Absolutely. So if we take a broader view of this for a second, the whole issue really, what are the next steps? What would, Colin, what would you say needs to be done by all the stakeholders, from governmental organisations to farmers, to actively maintain healthy ecosystems and biodiversity?
Well, we don't set out as farmers to harm anything. But what we are guilty of is not questioning enough some of the practices we've used over the years, or got used to doing over the years. It's a generational thing. There's often, well, my father did that, or my grandfather did that. So that's the reason we've got to carry on in the same vein. There are people out there now questioning the whole process that we've been, not trained into, but sort of, it's ingrained, it's embodied within us. And so it's up to us to question everything going forward. Why are we using, for example, triple superphosphate if it's not doing the job that it's supposed to? Why are we putting 300 kilos of nitrogen on a milling wheat sample to get milling wheat quality, when perhaps if we used it more efficiently, we could get that down, certainly on our farm, to 218 or 230 kilos? We need to question what we're doing, why we're doing it. And I reiterate, we do not set out to harm anything, but we've got so used to doing a certain way that we've done in the past that we sort of fall into it as a better way of doing things. And the cover crop is a classic example of that. It doesn't fit, and it costs extra. So why are we doing it? We've never done it before. Why are we suddenly saying this is the way to go? But if you look into any soil scientist or look into any book on soil, we need to keep feeding those microbes, and we need to help that. So the stakeholders need to be aware that at the end of the day, we're producing food. We're producing food that we want to be as nutrient dense as possible and as healthy as possible for the consumer. But we also can't do that with a little help and a little bit of acknowledgement that perhaps we need to do things away from the way we've done them traditionally.
Go on, use the word differently. Go on, you can do it.
Do things differently, yes.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, this is interesting, though, isn't it? Because farming is a very traditional sector. It's got a long history. It's got culture. You're tied to the land. So, you know, I think people have seen farming as a place, as an area stuck in its ways. But I see that changing. In a lot of the discussions that I've had, people are interested in change. They're interested in different. They, you know, you're not stupid. As you say, you know, this is vital to you and the longevity of your land and your work and culture and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully this doesn't come across too badly, but what we have lost is the true value of food. And food has become this commodity where you've got to produce it as cheaply as possible. And the way to do that is to throw left, right and centre and throw all these different products at it and produce this big commodity and this heap of wheat, for example. And it's not that anymore, because that's the wrong way of approaching these things. We on our farm educate the school kids. We bring the kids here to explain where their food comes from. It's not just a supermarket. And we're trying to do it in a slightly different way than we've done in the past. And we're trying to educate the people around us that it has a value. It's not a commodity. It is something we all need.
Yeah, and hooray for that. All power to your elbow. Okay, so Eloise, last question is for you. From the view of the crop nutrition producer, what's your opinion on this, about what needs to be done?
I think certainly adoption of new practices is essential. And in that, you're talking about new products. And obviously, we're here looking at Poly4. And I think that plays a key role in the future sustainability of agriculture, not just in the UK, but in the world. So there will need to be a period of adopting that new product and adopting a new way of working with it. But, you know, we do need support, as Colin's already said. Farmers, they are operating businesses on huge scales, and they do need the support from the government. And I think that's the way that it's going to come, is that, like Colin's just mentioned about cover crops, they cost money. They cost money to buy the seed, to put them in, and then to destroy them again. So we need to make sure that farmers are incentivized to do it, because with the best will in the world, they're not charities, and they do need to make a profit at the end of the day for them to be able to survive and for their business to thrive as well. And not only that, but for it to be either passed on through the family or for somebody else to then take over. So I think that's where it's going to come from. And I'm all for getting rid of red tape and all this sort of thing, but it's where it comes from, isn't it? And I think Colin can probably agree that subsidies are needed, and it's not something that we can move away from very quickly. And we certainly can't expect farmers to start doing practices that will cost them money. Yes, it will help the land, but they do need some incentives there, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, you simply can't afford to do it. Well, both Eloise Griffin-Hicks and Colin Chappell, thank you so much, because I think you've made a complex subject absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this episode has been made in partnership with Anglo-American, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you fancy it, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.